ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This will had come about in the most suspicious circumstances you could possibly imagine.
Who gets what when someone dies, and who decides?
The difficulty with undue influence often is proving it.
Join me, Damien Carrick, for the Law Report special series on wills, Over My Dead Body.
The person felt like they had no option. It's difficult to prove that.
To hear, search for The Law Report and look out for Over My Dead Body. Find it on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford. That's music by J.S. Bach, probably, from his Anna Magdalena notebook, played by Jeffrey Tozer. And it's the first track from the first album that Tall Poppies Records ever released. Tall Poppies was really just Belinda Webster. She not only produced and engineered the records, she designed the covers and edited the booklets, and she died last week at the age of 74. Later on today's show, James Ellis Ford, also a producer of quite a few albums that we've played on The Music Show, under the name of James Ford. When he's James Ellis Ford, he makes his own music, and he'll tell us about that and also about making a record whilst having chemo. And some old friends of The Music Show's, the Cafe of the Gate of Salvation. They're turning 40 and they're in the studio to sing for us. But first, back to Belinda Webster. Tall Poppies Records started in 1991, so the record label is as old as this show. They specialised in classical music and jazz, played by Australian musicians and as often as not composed by Australians. But there were also forays into other sorts of music. Riley Lee, for example, provided several albums of music for Shakuhachi, and there were David Lumsden's marvellous recordings of Birdsong. To say that Belinda Webster did this on a shoestring is an understatement. She never had any money, but she put out 278 recordings over 35 years, and we have played dozens and dozens of them here on The Music Show. She became a fixture of Australian music. At the start of 2006, I sat down with her at her kitchen table in Kangaroo Valley, New South Wales, to record an interview for this show. And I mentioned to her that I'd recently been speaking to Jeffrey Tozer, who had expressed his liking for recording music in long stretches. And I asked Belinda if she had strong feelings about this.
I do have strong feelings. And yes, different people like to record in different ways. And I think also different people have different reactions to the recording studio. When the red light goes on, some people tense up and they get, you know, there's a bit of stress there that they wouldn't have normally. So things happen in their performances that they wouldn't particularly want. But part of the joy of making a recording is creating an environment where that won't happen. So you're creating and trying to create an environment where a musician can relax and knows that you're on side, and if something goes wrong, that's okay. You're not going to sort of chuck a tantrum and send them home. And so you're creating a nurturing environment so that the musician can do their best work. And coming to the business of multiple takes and editing. I would love to find a musician who can come in and do single takes, because, I mean, editing is another part of the process. It's the process I probably enjoy the least, I suppose, because my ideal, if the world was perfect, which it never will be, I would like to only ever put out live concert recordings. But the world is not perfect, and not many people can do a whole concert note perfect so that they can stand to listen to it for the next 20 years. So that's why we go into the recording studio. Notwithstanding that you're in a studio and you're in a sort of fairly esoteric kind of environment in terms of making music, I still want all the recordings I make to sound like they're just played there in front of you in a concert. So the editing process has to take that into account, because it's got a sound flowing. And whole takes, as Jeffrey Tozer is absolutely right, whole takes are crucial. And if you can get a whole beautiful take that flows through and just fix up a few little bits and pieces, then you don't lose the flow, but it's all sounding perfect. If you're cobbling together a recording out of many, many, many takes, it's very hard to get a good flow. I'll never forget when I was in England on a New South Wales Women and Arts Fellowship back in 1992, I met among many producers that I met this guy who was crying to me about how he'd done 357 edits on some piece. And I said, I bet it sounded like a dog's breakfast at the end. And he just didn't know how to respond to that. He didn't know where I was coming from. We had a bit of a talk about it, but he was actually more proud of the fact that he had the technical skill to do that many edits.
Do you regard your role as being creative?
Not really. No, I don't have any delusions or illusions about that. It's creative to the point where you might be making decisions about the sound, but that's not creative. I mean, that's like choosing what colour to paint your house. I mean, I'm trying to capture the creativity of the musician. So my work is a subsidiary role in that sense. Important, but subsidiary.
Let me put it another way. You played the flute for many years. Do you regard yourself as a musician when you're recording other musicians?
Absolutely. If I wasn't a musician, I wouldn't be able to talk to these people. I wouldn't be able to say, look, I'm really sorry, but in bar 25, that really sounded like a funny note there. Or what about that crescendo? That really is going to make this piece flower at this point. You can't say that unless you know what you're talking about. And if I didn't know what I was talking about, I wouldn't be here talking to you now.
Go and Ian Munro from Tall Poppy's 277. I was dancing with a gnat, music of Ekaterina Komolkova, produced and recorded by Belinda Webster, who died last week at 74. You're listening to The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford. James Ellis Ford, no relation, as far as I know, is perhaps not a name you've heard on The Music Show before, but take out the Ellis and you probably have. James Ford has produced some of the albums that we have played and talked about. Fontaine's DC's Romance, for instance, and Black Country New Roads' Forever How Long. We've talked about both of those and To the Bands, and Pulp, and Florence and the Machine, and Arctic Monkeys, lots and lots of others. He's basically doing the Double J playlist. And he's just released a second solo album. It's called Lost in Another World. And we'll talk to him about the extraordinary circumstances, I think unique, we can say, circumstances in which he made this record. First of all, here's a song called Did You Ever Want to Go to Your Own Funeral?
Again.
That's Did You Ever Want to Go to Your Own Funeral? And it comes from Lost in Another World, the work of James Ellis Ford, who joins me now on The Music Show. Welcome to the show, James.
Hi.
This other world, tell us about it.
Basically, I was diagnosed with leukemia last year, and I ended up in the hospital being treated. And part of the chemotherapy meant that I had to basically be kept like a boy in the bubble with no immune system in a small white room, you know, with a bed and a bathroom, but that was pretty much it, for quite a long time, a few months at a time, while my immune system came back. And yeah, so it really felt to me that I was in a parallel sort of version of my life. I had a window, I could see real life going on outside, but I couldn't get to it. And it was like, yeah, literally like being lost in another world.
Not everybody, not even every record producer, would think that this was a cue to make a record. Why did you decide to be not just to kind of throw your hands up and say, you know, this is awful, but to decide to be positive and creative?
I think that was exactly it. You know, it's a revolt against the void, as is said. You know, I was sort of under the cosh, feeling awful for a few months, and then the period where I made my album, I was coming out, my energy was coming back for the first time, and I started to have creative thoughts, and I just wanted to make some music. I make music every day of my life normally, and I love it, and it regulates my mental health, and I felt it was a really good way for me to try and reconnect myself with the person that I recognized and, you know, cheer myself up as much as anything. So my wife brought in a little table and my studio laptop and a microphone, and, you know, pretty much in the period of about 2 weeks, I made the whole record.
Did you have a plan at all, or did you just sort of start making sounds and one thing led to another?
Yeah, I'd say it was more the second one. I had a few little sketches of kind of drones and maybe a synth arpeggio or something like that on my laptop that I was listening to. And then, yeah, I suppose I had melodic ideas. I had a little keyboard, and I just started noodling around. And then, you know, I obviously had a lot in my head about, you know, processing the situation that I was in. So I started singing, and honestly, it just kind of came out as a stream of consciousness. And, you know, I went back and tweaked the lyrics, obviously, but pretty much what came out was the first thing I thought about, you know. So it's quite direct and sort of no filter in that way, which, you know, makes me cringe a little bit when I look back on it now. But in the moment, it felt like the right thing to do.
It must be very difficult listening back to it not to associate it with that room.
Yeah, you know, I'm doing a bunch of press and I'm getting together a little live show, and yeah, it's not the nicest experience, if I'm honest with you, because, you know, I'm not fully out of the woods health-wise, but I'm trying to kind of remove myself from that situation. And obviously this pulls me back in quite regularly. So, but, you know, I'm happy that it exists. It feels like an honest sort of photograph of where I was for a few months of the darkest period of my life, I suppose.
And it's obviously a very self-contained album, because it's you in your room with, you know, no other musicians. You're doing everything, and you're doing it on a laptop. So yeah. Because the previous album you went full Mike Oldfield and played, you know, loads of instruments, but you didn't have the instruments this time. So it's very, very minimal from that point of view.
Yeah, you know, I'm currently sitting in my studio in my house, and I'm surrounded by, you know, old synths and drum machines and equipment. In a strange way, it was kind of liberating to not have access to any of that stuff. You know, I was literally thinking about the melody and the chords and what I could do with my little limited system. And, you know, I'm always banging on about the benefits of limitations to other people during the production process, but I had those limitations enforced upon me, you know, and actually it was, like I say, almost the easiest music making process I've ever had.
Did you actually feel that the limitations were forcing your imagination to go into overdrive?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I had a very limited set of tools, and I kind of stuck to them as a palette. But I think, you know, with me, melodies and that kind of thing come quite easily. It's like the sort of lyrical part of it that I haven't spent that much time doing in my life, really. And actually, you know, in that situation, that bit was really easy because I had lots of, you know, stuff to write about, lots of thought processes and lots of conversations with people where there was little ideas. So, yeah, I suppose, like I said before, it felt like it just sort of flowed really easily, you know.
It sounds as though it flowed easily, I must admit. And whilst, I mean, quite a bit of it is slow and introspective in a sense, a lot of it isn't. I mean, the opening track, Overtone, skips along, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's a few kind of quite sort of peppy sounding things, which I suppose in retrospect seems a little odd. But, you know, honestly, I was trying to lift my mood and concentrate on the positive things in my life. There's little kind of pep talks to myself of, you know, this is going to be okay, and little kind of messages of love to my wife and my little boy. Yeah, I didn't want to dwell on the doom. There's so much kind of doom around that situation, and also obviously in the actual world outside at the minute, that, you know, I was actively trying to steer in the opposite direction.
You're listening to The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford, and I'm talking to James Ford, or James Ellis Ford, as he is when he puts out his own music and when he's not being somebody else's producer. That was Overtones, and it comes from the album Lost in Another World. So at what point in the process did you decide you were going to release this, that you had an album?
It was kind of much later, actually, after I'd sort of finished the first round of treatment, as it were. During the process, I was sending it to my dad and a few kind of musical friends just to kind of get a bit of feedback and sort of start a conversation, really. But then it was only really afterwards when I sent it to my manager and sort of listened back to it that I realized that there was probably a record there. And actually, my manager sent it onto Domino, who I've got a kind of fairly long-term relationship with, and they instantly said they wanted to put it out. And it was really only at that point that I kind of sequenced the record and I actually got it mixed by someone else, because I didn't want to open it up again, really. You know, I sort of wanted to leave it as it was, as a sort of document. And also I didn't want to, you know, fiddle with it really either. So yeah, it was a sort of an afterthought in a way to put it out.
Yeah, so there was never any suggestion of, you know, overdubs, bringing in a choir or anything like that?
Quite honestly, I did open up one or two tunes in my studio here and then started to like fiddle a bit, and then I kind of got the fear. And yeah, because my original intention to make, you know, a record before I got ill was to do something with, you know, musicians, maybe something more kind of ambitious and orchestral, maybe involving a choir or you know, string players and stuff. But obviously, the universe kind of conspired against me, and this is what happened.
We should talk about what happened next, which is that, you know, you left hospital and you went back to work and you produced two Mercury Prize nominated records. Congratulations. But
thank you.
Did you find that you carried with you some of that experience? Were you a different producer?
Well, you know, the Help record was actually another big loop on the roller coaster, to be honest with you, because I came out of my first round of treatment and then I had a stem cell transplant, which is protective against, you know, the disease coming back. And I was feeling good and we'd been talking about doing the Help record. And so I reached out to a lot of people and kind of started organizing this whole record. And, you know, basically Abbey Road gave us a week. And, you know, in there we had Damon doing a song that he'd written for it with a big collaboration, and Arctic Monkeys and Fontaines, etc., were all lined up. And I was meant to be bobbing around producing in the studio. And then the week before, I got a mouth ulcer, checked my bloods, and I had no immune system again. And it turned out my stem cell transplant actually failed. So I ended up back in the hospital, and actually during the Abbey Road sessions, I was in the ICU and nearly died. And then basically I ended up back pretty much in the same room, and I got the files from the session, and I ended up mixing the Arctic Monkeys song on the War Child record in the hospital. And I attended a few sessions remotely, kind of over Zoom with, you know, Olivia Rodrigo, et cetera. So it was a whole other sort of album that, again, it helped me focus on something else that wasn't being ill, I suppose, you know, and kind of gave me a reason to get up in the morning. But, you know, the irony of it happening like that, you know, doesn't escape me.
No, this is record producing as extreme sport, isn't it?
It is a little bit. It's been the most bizarre year, yeah, you know. But I'm still here, and I'm, you know, you asked, has it changed me? Like, I think a situation like this can't help but change someone, you know. I definitely feel a different attachment to being alive, and you know, I am definitely sort of more focused and clearer on what is important to me in life, you know, and I only really want to spend the time that I have doing things that I am really invested in and really love. Otherwise, I'd rather be spending that time in nature or with my family. You know, I've traditionally been a workaholic, and I'm trying to redress that balance a little bit.
But there was something very fitting, I think, about you doing this Help album, because you're working with all of these people that you've worked with before. It was almost like kind of this is your life, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. And in a way, like, the Abbey Road session was almost like my own private Glastonbury. It was like all of the my friends that I've worked with over many years. And then, you know, literally not being allowed to go to it was absolutely gutting, you know. But, yeah, it was a hugely sort of life-affirming project in many ways. You know, all of the producers and engineers that pulled together to make it happen in my absence, and obviously all the artists that contributed for free and gave songs and wrote songs, it sort of gave me faith in humanity and in our sort of music industry. And obviously it was for a cause I greatly believe in. You know, I think it's fairly uncontroversial to want to help children in war zones, you know. So it was an incredible experience, just a very bizarre one.
Maybe, James, we could talk before we finish about Brian Eno, because there was something you said earlier about lying in bed and sort of singing nonsense into a microphone and then maybe coming back and changing the odd word, but on the whole, going with the nonsense. And yeah. I remember Eno saying almost exactly this to me in an interview for this show some years ago, that he would encourage people in the recording studio not to worry too much about getting the lyrics right if they had the music in their head. Is that an Eno thing you were doing, do you think?
I think the spectre of Brian Eno is never too far away from me. You know, I kind of grew up, I suppose, with my dad was quite a big Canterbury prog sort of head, and that music kind of resonates with me. But then also, you know, obviously his solo records, along with all the production he's done and his ideas about music, you know, and also he actually himself had weirdly made a hospital kind of record. I think Music for Airports, or one of those, was conceived in a period of illness, you know. So it sort of doesn't escape me that, you know, I'm not trying to follow down his line, but he definitely has been a big influence on me. But to be honest, the kind of singing rhubarb thing, I actually kind of have seen a lot of people write like that. And the person who sticks in my head actually is Damon Albarn, who is an incredibly creative force, and he is just has no embarrassment or shame about doing that in a room full of people, and will just, you know, sing whatever's on in his head. And you know, I've seen him write songs on the fly, and the vocal has been the final vocal. You know, it's a real freedom if you can write like that. So I suppose I was trying to emulate that in my own little way, you know.
We should go out, I think, maybe with a track from Help 2. Do you want to choose something?
I think I might choose the Beth Gibbons cover version of The Velvet Underground. That was something that we actually did most of it together here in my studio, but I actually mixed it on the hospital ward, and I had to keep, I just find Beth's voice so emotional. As I was mixing it, I had to keep stopping it and walking away as I was kind of in tears. You know, it just made me well up. I think I was so kind of a heightened emotional state myself. I found it actually quite hard to mix yeah. it without crying. So, but I do think it's a really beautiful track. So
we'll listen to that. But before we do, James, how are you?
I'm okay. Like I say, the stem cell transplant failed, so I'm technically at a higher risk of the disease coming back, you know. So I'm being closely monitored, having my bloods done very regularly. But apart from that, you know, I'm a little immunocompromised, but otherwise feeling fine, you know. I just got back from a holiday. You know, my energy is good. I've lots of creative things to work on, you know. Family life is good. Yeah, I'm feeling really good, and you know, I will take the up.
Fair enough. Thank you very much for talking to me. Very good to meet you.
Yeah, you too, Andy. Thanks very much.
This is Sunday Morning, Beth Gibbons. Brings the dawn in. Beth Gibbons singing the Velvet Underground song Sunday Morning as part of Help 2. The producer and my guest was James Ellis Ford. His record Lost in Another World is out now from Domino Records. You're listening to The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford. If you're a long-term listener to the show, Cafe of the Gate of Salvation will be a familiar name to you, albeit wordy. They're a gospel choir and they are celebrating their 40th birthday. And for their birthday, we've asked them into the music show studio. And we're going to start by listening to a song called Be Thankful. Cafe of the Gate of Salvation, soloist Lisa Spence, take it away.
Maybe in a big city, or driving down a country lane, working two jobs to make a living. All you do is complain when you should be thankful.
Waking up in the morning and seeing the sunrise.
Well,
it's enough to say I thank you, Lord.
I thank you, Lord.
Rolling over, seeing my baby's eyes.
Well,
it's enough to say I thank you, Lord.
I
just want to say now.
Thank you,
thank you,
thank you,
thank you.
I thank you, Lord.
Thank you, Lord.
Thank you,
thank you,
thank you, Lord.
I thank you, Lord. You should be thankful.
You may live on the highest hill. Some people say you don't do nothing but take doctor's pills. You may be in a nursery or in a classroom, driving your big fine car. Anywhere's gonna take you afar.
I thank you, Lord.
Living out in the sun.
Thank you, Lord.
Thank you,
thank you,
thank you,
thank you.
I thank you, Lord.
Thank you, Lord.
Thank you,
thank you,
thank you,
thank you,
Lord.
Lord, you should be thankful.
Ooh, I'm so
all
thankful for
so
everything
all
I got.
You should be thankful.
Yeah, yeah, you should now.
For all
think
you
about
got
it, think about it.
You
should be
thankful.
Thank you very much indeed. That was the Cafe at the Gate of Salvation, Be Thankful, featuring Lisa Spence with Tony Backhouse conducting. And it's great to have you all back in the studio. I'm joined by two members of the choir, Frank Zeichner and Zoe Vraknes, who's also the Assistant Artistic Director. The last time the choir was in here was for your 25th anniversary, and Tony, who did the interview on that occasion, said that what had changed in the 25 years was that the median age had lowered. And I'm wondering if it's still going down and if you're going to become a children's choir eventually.
I'm not sure that that's true. It went up a bit for a while, but I think it's going down now. We have pretty regular auditions, and I'm pleased to say that younger people are coming back.
Right.
Yeah, I'd like to say that we have quite a variety of age, which is really exciting, old and new, and people who have been around since the very beginning and some
who
have
joined. How many people here have been here the whole time? Okay.
Maybe, yeah, five okay. or so. Yes, right. Veterans.
Yes. But on the whole, everybody looks very young.
Would you say?
Thank I would say much. So, yes. Yeah.
I particularly look young.
You particularly. Well, yes, particularly. So when you join a choir like this, I mean, if you have to audition?
Yes, so we are an auditioned choir. Fairly rigorous to get through. We do really like to have a certain level of singer. We have people from all backgrounds of training. Some have trained, some haven't. Most important to us is probably the gospel feel.
How do you measure that?
You feel it. Now, I mean, it's about rhythm mostly, actually.
Yeah.
Rhythm, yeah.
Yes.
And do you need to know some of the repertoire, or can you sort of be taught all of that?
No, we've got a few that have come from, you know, dubious backgrounds, liking musicals and things, but they get in anyway.
Right. And we've got some people who have jazz trained and all sorts. But I think most of it can be, picked up and taught as we go along, which is really cool.
And what about the repertoire? I mean, the song that we just heard then, for example, where do you come by these songs? Do you get them from recordings or?
Well, I mean, Tony is the biggest source.
Yes.
He either writes them or he arranges them or he finds them. Although the choir's history is that in the early days particularly, quite a few people wrote their own, and there was a lot more distributed input. And from now and again that happens, but I'd say 90% of the songs are Tony origin.
Right, okay. And do you expand the repertoire all the time, or do you kind of rest on your laurels and repeat the same sorts of songs?
We do. We're constantly expanding. It's really nice to be able to sing. I mean, for our upcoming concert, we are singing songs that we learned at the very beginning. We're constantly having Tony write new things or arrange new things, which is really exciting that we can sing all sorts of things.
What about becoming a soloist like Lisa, for instance? I mean, how do you get to be a soloist? Do you put your hand up or do you get tapped?
In the old days it was tapped. And there's still a little bit of that maybe, but it's more rigorous nowadays. People put their hands up. We have depths. We have an opportunity when people don't turn up. So we like the idea that it's more distributed. But the people who love to sing solo tend to come to the fore more.
Yeah. So what, I mean, Frank, you've been in this choir for how many years now?
Since 21 years.
That's quite a long time. So what has changed in your time in the choir?
Oh, man. It was interesting. I came at a time about 2 years before Tony left. So I was there, and then we changed quite a lot. Different conductor, different conductors. We had COVID. But if anything, I think we've sort of become pickier about who we choose to be in the choir. So the standard has sort of risen because of that to some degree. But the other thing that's happened that's been quite an interesting change in the last few years when Tony's come is... Tony came back.
Yes.
He came back.
Yes.
Is that he didn't leave any of the stuff by itself. We came back and he started fiddling with stuff we've been singing for 30 mm-hmm. years.
Yeah.
So it just... And so we sort of like a creative instrument for him, which we love, and I think Tony does too.
Yeah, and it's so you still fiddle? I mean, the performances, the songs are still changing.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, the groaning, you know, like we've been doing that for 25 years. Are you kidding me? We have to change.
And we still have a little bit of on-the-fly changing as well, as is the case in showbiz.
Yeah, yeah, but you don't, yes, because you're not allowed to say, we don't do it like that.
Oh, no.
And Zoe, maybe I could ask you the question that always gets asked, which is the relationship of this choir with religion.
Great question. So we have people from all faiths, or none, if that's the case, too, in the choir. I think for many people, the music is the spiritual thing. So that's, yes, we sing a lot about God and Jesus, but yes, people can take the meaning from it that they will, and it's really the music that is the powerful force.
And you sing, and you, when you sing it, you believe it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. You have to have that conviction, I think, for it to come through to the audience.
Yeah. Yes. What about other choirs? I mean, because you know, obviously, you know, you can also sing the Bach B minor Mass and without being a Christian.
Sure.
But I wonder whether, because, you know, choristers love to sing, are any of you in other choirs?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, yeah. We have quite a few in other choirs.
So it's kind of Monday night.
Philharmonia Choir, yeah. You know, other choirs, etc. Yeah, no, dare I say it, musicals, you know. Yeah. Yeah.
That's the second
Frank.
The second reference you've made to musicals. There's nothing wrong with musicals, you know. Thank you very much indeed for coming in. Congratulations. Happy birthday. And it's wonderful to have the studio full of you. You're going to conduct the second number. What's this one, Zoe?
The next song is One Step by Donald Vales.
And what do we know about this?
It's an old secular song that was converted to a gospel song, which is sort of seemingly against the trend. So I find that quite interesting.
Oh, yeah, it usually goes the other way, doesn't it?
It usually goes the other way.
This little light of mine becomes this little girl of mine.
Oh, my God, they sold the gospel tune to secular. Oh, my God, and this went the other way. So quite interesting in that regard.
Frank Zeichner, Zoe Bruckner's Cafe of the Gate of Salvation, Tony Backhouse, thank you very much, all of you, for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
One step, oh, one step, oh,
all I have to do is make one step, and he will do the rest, the rest, the rest.
Ooh.
Ooh, one step,
oh, one step, oh,
all I have to do is make one step, and he will do the rest, the rest, the rest.
Oh,
day by day,
I make one step
by step.
He'll do the rest.
He will do the rest.
I will do the rest.
He will do the rest.
Oh, if I make,
I make
one
just
step.
One step.
He'll do the rest.
He will do the rest.
He'll do the rest.
He will do the rest. One step.
Oh, oh,
all I have to do is make one step, and he will do the rest, the rest, the rest.
Oh,
one step.
Oh,
one step.
Oh, I may.
All I have to do is make one step, and he will do the rest, the rest, the rest.
Oh, if I may.
Step by step,
he'll do the rest.
He will do the rest.
I will do the rest.
He will do the rest.
Oh, if I make,
I make
one
just
step.
One step,
he'll do the rest.
He will do the rest.
He'll do the rest.
He will do the rest. One step,
oh, oh,
one step,
oh, I make.
All I have to do is make one step. All I have to do is make one step. All I have to do is make one step. All I have to do is make one step. All I have to do is make one step. All I have to do is make one step.
All I have to do is make one step.
All I have to do is make one step.
All I have to do is make one step. All I have to do is make one step. All I have to do is make one step. And he will do the rest. The rest. The
Cafe of the Gate of Salvation, and that's One Step, and they recorded it live in the Music Show studio. Their 40th anniversary gig is this Sunday, the 23rd of August, at the Factory Theatre in Sydney. I gather it's pretty much sold out, but you could sort of try and fight your way in. Details on the Music Show's website. Next time on the Music Show, Aja Monet is turning poetry into song, and she's asking us to think about the music of a conversation. And we welcome back the composer Thomas Meadowcroft, who has written a concerto for Foley artists, that's to say sound effects and orchestra.
Sandwiches, sandwiches. Listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.